What do you do for a living?
I invoke my right under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and decline to answer the question.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, folks. Welcome to the Ice House, beautiful old classic Ice House building in Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
We're back again for the second episode of our interview with one of the men who did it, out of the mouths of men who did it. We're here with our good friend from Las Vegas, Frank Culotta. Say hello, Frank.
Hey, how you doing?
I love that. Hey, how you doing? That's a classic there, Frank. I was thinking about, you know, what some of the things that you did and some of the things I did on the police department. I remember we had this, we had inside information. There was a source. The source didn't go along on the burglary. It was a bank burglary. But we knew this guy was going to do a bank burglary. And my job and another guy, we set up inside of a pizza shop just right across the little shopping mall. It was a suburban shopping mall. And they closed down the pizza shop, and we just stayed inside waiting for them to come in and rob the bank. We had the airplane up, and we had about 10 guys in cars surrounding the bank and watching some of these guys, and we like watched them leave their house, and then the plane got on them, and they drove around. They drove around to clean themselves off, and they drove around, and they went in, and they looked at the bank, and they looked around, and they went back out and drove around some more trying to see if there was any tail. And, of course, the airplane was up, and there was cars. I mean, there was cars at every intersection but back off the road so they could report as they went by an intersection. And finally, they dropped them off in the bank, and the guy, the wheel man, he went back up on a hill looking down over the bank, and they had walkie-talkies. They had the whole nine yards, and they got inside. We had somebody up high enough they could see them go through the roof of the bank, and then after they went out of sight down in the bank, then they took off the wheel man, and we had a SWAT team that came in and went into the bank, and there they are standing there with a big drill with a magnet on it on the side of the vault, drilling into the vault. Does any of that sound familiar to you, Frank?
Yeah, we've done a few of them. Yeah.
I like how Gary says clean them.
Yeah, we've done a few of them.
Themselves
and, you know, we got busted in that one place.
Yeah, I know. Folks, Frank was part of the hole in the wall gang, yeah. And that's because so you wouldn't set off an alarm at the door or the window, they would break through the concrete wall in like a concrete block building. You could break through the wall with sledgehammers or go down through the roof. And that was kind of before they had motion detectors. And anymore, they've got motion detectors. I've got a camera in my house that as soon as somebody walks in, it starts videotaping. So things have changed a little bit, Frank.
A lot.
Now, when
anybody that tries to steal nowadays is nuts.
Really?
Now, when you were doing the burglaries, were you doing them in Las Vegas or would you leave town?
I've done them all over the country, everywhere I could go. But while I lived in Las Vegas, I did them mostly in Las Vegas and Arizona.
Right. Whatever.
The last one we'd done, we got caught, and that was Bertha's.
What I was going to ask you is, as Gary kind of was describing how on the police side they had 20, 30 guys, a plane in the air, all these things following a SWAT
right.
team. You know, to catch a what could be three or four guys going into a bank, how did you guys go about picking your targets?
Well, I had inside information on this particular robbery that there was going to be close to $2 million in the walk-in vault. That it was a business that the people that owned it, they just didn't go to the banks. They just put their money into the vault in their business. And the place had an alarm system on it, you know, and they had, I think they did have motion detectors, but we weren't concerned about that. I could have shut off the alarm in the front of the building, but there was too much traffic. So I just figured we'd just go through the roof and cut a hole in the top of the vault, drop in the vault. I knew there was no sound in the vault or motion detectors. And I knew that we would get this kind of money and jewelry out of there from the tipster, who was related to the people that owned the building, the business. The only problem is one of my guys on my crew decided to do it on his own. He filled in this guy by the name of Sal Romano. And I didn't like Sal Romano because I had a terrible gut feeling about this guy not being a good guy. And prior to us going on that robbery, two Chicago detectives flew out to Vegas and asked me if I was stealing with Sal because they felt as though Sal was working with the government. And then they explained why they knew that, because they had Sal busted on a load of furs that he took from Vegas to Chicago, and they busted him at the airport. So that's federal crime, transportation. Stolen property from one state to another. So the government stepped in and took the case away from the local police department, and then it disappeared off the dockets. This is what they were telling me. And they weren't looking for any money. These were just a couple of guys I know that were on the force for a long time and became criminal intelligence unit detectives. So I told Tony I didn't want to go on the score no more because I didn't trust Sal. Ernie filled him in, and Tony said, Sal's okay. He's a good guy. I don't believe them cops, this and that. Tony was thinking of that money. So he convinced me to go on it. Then he wanted me to fill in that ex-cop, Joe Blasco. They used to be working a Metro out there. So I filled him in. I had to put him on police radios like anybody could listen to a police radio. And we proceeded to do the robbery. But I had this bad feeling, and I was right. Sal Romano, as soon as they made entry, the feds were on the roof adjoining Billy, and they could look right down at my guys digging the hole in the roof. There was, from what I understand, 20 FBI agents and 15 Metro cops. Like Larry said, Gary said, you know, they stationed themselves all over the place. We usually had better radio systems than then, but being that the FBI was involved, everything was upgraded. And as soon as they made entry, boom, that was it. Everybody got busted except Sal, because Sal was with the feds.
Whatever happened?
That was the end of organized crime.
Yeah, whatever happened to Sal Romano, do you know? You have any idea? Did he just disappear in the witness protection program?
I have no idea. Last time I heard he testified in a case, a family secrets trial in Chicago.
Oh, did he?
And he was confined to a wheelchair. Yeah, confined to a wheelchair. I don't know where he's at. No, I don't care. You know, the guy did what he had to do. You know, he changed my life around. Because chances are, if that didn't happen, I'd have probably been killed or put in jail forever.
Frank, you're right.
It worked out for me.
Really, if it hadn't been for that bust, you'd either be dead or in the penitentiary, and you're not. You're like nationally known, probably world famous in some subculture, shall we say. I know there's a lot of fans in England and Australia and all the English speaking countries because of Facebook. We've got a bunch of them for this podcast, and you've been on other podcasts, so people know you all over the world. Plus, You're like really well known in Las Vegas doing the mob tour.
Yeah, it's not called a mob tour.
No, what do you call it?
Just so people understand.
Okay, what do you call it? I was thinking
it's called Frank Collado's Casino Mob Tour.
Okay.
Frank Collado's Casino Mob Tour. In other words, I show them all the sites where the movie was shot, Casino, the locations, and I talk about the murders. Talk about Tony. I run down history, and people have a lot of questions. And I do it. Actually, it's a private tour. And I take two, three people in my personal car, and I drive them all around town. We have pizza dinner afterwards. They could buy books. And I got people from Canada, Australia, Germany. I never seen so many people from different countries that want to know about organized crime. It's amazing. It's doing rather well. And if anybody wants to reach it, you mind if I give them that business number?
No, go ahead.
The number to reach in case you want to go on that private tour is area code 702-622-0850. And that line is direct to me. You'll hear a recording, and I will call you back and book you in.
All right, great.
You know, it's I got 65 5-stars. It's unheard of.
Wow, that's cool. Like I told you before, my friend Barry Parks, one of our fans here, went out there, and he was praising you all up to me after he got back and the tour, how much fun it was, and how he'd recommend anybody take that tour.
I'm with him for people like 3 hours, you know.
Wow. Well, and the thing is, of course, I mean, you could, you know, like Gary has somebody he knows here who's doing the walking tour, but that person really just learned the history and then is retelling it to people, as opposed to
right.
You, Frank Culotta, who lived the history, and you're going to spend three. I mean, I'm amazed I get to sit here and talk with you by phone. So I can't imagine what it's like to hang out for 3 hours and get the you know, the casino mob tour from all those locations from the movie, from the man who it's about.
You know, Frank, that movie Casino made a huge difference in your life and made a huge difference in this whole business of mob history. It seems to me like it really generated a lot of interest in it. The Sopranos has helped a little bit, but that movie really, really put everybody on the
Casino,
on
the movie Casino, really, really. I didn't, you know, when I died, you know, I was a consultant in that movie. And I spent 6 months doing that movie on the set, and I acted in it, and I showed, well, I think when I hear this one, I was a consultant. I sat right next to Scorsese on one of the director chairs.
Yeah, really?
So they were doing a scene, and I said, nah, that's not the way that guy was killed. And Marty said, why do you know? I said, because I killed him. And Marty said, what? He says, well, then you do the scene. Then he threw me into the scene. Well, it was this guy. His name was Listener. He was a government informant. And we found out that he was testifying against Tony Splaccio and myself in Washington, D.C., and we found out through a friend that owned this restaurant, because this guy's lawyer happened to be in there, and he was telling him, this friend of ours, that his client was testifying against Splaccio and Culotta. This guy acted like he didn't know us, and as soon as the lawyer left, he called us and told us. So then Tony says, you got to kill him. And I said, well, they're going to subpoena me. He says, yeah. I says, you know, they'll probably give me immunity. And I said, yeah, I'll talk. I said, I'll tell him whatever I think I want to tell him at the time. So I did. I went in there, had to go to Washington, D.C., and I testified, and I lied. As soon as I got back, Tony said, well, you got to kill him now real quick. And then a week went by, and Tony was getting real nervous. Come on, you got to do it. You got to do it right away, or else I'll go do it. So then a couple days later, I was able to get it together and go and kill this guy. And the guy was very difficult. He didn't want to die. Nobody really wants to die, but I shot him in the head 6 times and he was still alive. So fortunately, the guy in the car that was listening to the radio, police radios, came in the house with reloads. Who ever thought of that, right?
Really?
You know, a million years would have thought of that. And he brought him in. I looked at him like, what the hell? Could you see through the building, you know, the wall? And we reloaded and then emptied it out and threw him in the pool.
That's right. Threw
him in the pool with him, too.
I remember that in the movie. You had to kind of chase him all through the house and finally out into the back and
yeah,
took him down there.
Which I did. I chased him through the house, you know.
Yeah, it was here. I'm just looking because
so,
that's.
We shot that, you know.
That's listed in on your Wikipedia page. It would be October 10th of 79 would have been the murder of Sherwin Jerry Listener. And then the other person that you enlisted was here, at least it says, is Wayne Mattesi. Is that pronounced right?
It's correct.
Who was a friend of yours from Chicago.
Right.
And you were
karate expert.
Yeah, you used a .22 caliber. You were. Did you load your own rounds? Did you? You know, like.
Yeah, I did.
We did a great story about
because I was told.
We did a great story where we talked with about Ken Ito. You remember this, Gary?
Yeah.
Where the guys went to kill him.
Show the jab.
Yeah, and they shot him, and then they thought they killed him, and because they
Jasper Campese. Yeah. I know Jasper.
Because they loaded their own rounds, you know, they loaded their own shells. Right. They didn't kill him, and I'm just kind of curious. Did you do the same practice of loading your own shells?
Yes, I did. Yes, I loaded. I broke the loads down. I reloaded them. I put half rounds in there, half loads, because I was told that would keep the noise down, which it doesn't keep the noise down. It's actually, it still is loud, if not louder.
And then you still, and you shot the guy.
He came back in. He gave me the,
And so you shoot the guy six times in the head with half load rounds, and he's still running like in the movie. And so then Wayne comes in with more full loaded rounds, right?
Right.
And then you basically hold the guy down, or he holds the guy down while you reload the gun.
Damn,
he put a pillow on the back of the guy's head, and I put a pillow on the front of his head, and I proceeded to empty the revolver off. And then he died.
Well, that's a cold world. That's like the Jap, Joe the Jap story, where they Campese and I can't think of the other guy's name that killed him, and they didn't get him killed.
He was a state cop. He was a policeman, the other guy.
Oh, that's right, he was.
I knew Jasper. I knew Jasper real well.
But then they killed
Jasper
him.
Jasper was a crazy son of a bitch. Yeah, they killed him. Well, he didn't do the job. That's what happens when you don't do the job.
At Chicago, that's a rough place. That outfit is a rough place up there. It's
they were a rough bunch of guys. Then there's nothing there no more.
Well, I had a question about that because you guys dragged the body out. Here it says in the Wikipedia page, dumped it in the backyard pool, and then you cleaned up the blood off the furniture and the floor. Were you trying? I mean, obviously, you weren't trying to really hide the crime scene because you put the body in the pool.
We didn't clean up any blood in the house.
No,
because it was only his blood. What we did was we dragged him out to the pool because I didn't have any gloves on, and we walked in the water with him in the pool, and we started in the low end, 3 foot, and then he submerged and then came back up to the top. And then I went out to the car, and Wayne stood behind and searched the house looking for maybe a guy had a recording on or something. And he didn't find anything. And then he came back out to the car. Of course, the police radios was on all the while. And he shot the gun 12 times. You figure every neighbor in the block would have called, but nobody called.
Huh.
So 12 shots, not a call. Imagine that.
But they knew who... sure.
Nowadays, a million cell phones would have been ringing.
Yeah. Really?
But the people in the neighborhood knew who Sherwin Lister was as their neighbor.
I have no idea. Maybe they did. I don't know. I know his wife was a cocktail waitress. I never did see his kids. He said he had kids. I never seen him. I don't know if he had. So, and I don't even know how old they were at the time because I never seen them. He wouldn't have been a good family person to have kids anyway.
So that murder there, that was one you had to admit to the FBI, and then they gave you a pass on that in exchange for your future testimony.
They ask you a million thousand questions, but they always want to go back to murder, and you don't want to talk about murder because you know what they could do, if they're not loyal or live up to their agreements. So finally they convince you that they're your friend now, and this is what you have to do. So that's when I told them about that.
Well, they wanted old Tony Splatro awfully bad, didn't they? His reputation has preceded him. He got too big for his britches. He got too high profile, and the government pulled out all the stops to do him in, didn't they?
Yeah.
Frankie, Tony Splatro is really famous today. He's much more famous today than he ever was back then. I don't think he would have been so famous and not been for Joe Pesci and his depiction of Tony Spilotro, do you think?
You're probably right. You're probably right. Tony had a reputation, but he didn't have a reputation nationwide. Now he's got a reputation nationwide. Everybody knows Tony. They know all about Tony, people. That's why I knew it would be a good idea to write that book, because now I could tell him the real Tony. And he wasn't all bad. You know, I mean, everybody has a good side in their life. I told him about all that stuff, you know. And I told him how vicious he could be. So it's a real honest account of Tony, you know.
You know, and he seems to be a family man. I read online a letter. Somebody got a hold of a letter he wrote to his son, kind of counseling his son. And he just seemed like, you know, any dad that cared about his son writing his letter trying to give him some advice.
Strange thing about that, that was his adopted son. You're going to find out in my book how that adoption was arranged and how it was put together.
Oh, interesting. I didn't really realize that.
Oh, but, yeah. I was involved in that deal for him. Tony couldn't have children, nor could his wife. You're going to find out who the real father and mother were.
Well, folks, you better get that book. What's the name of that book again? We might as well drop that in. We didn't do that at the very start of the podcast here. What was the name of that book?
The name of the book is The Rise and Fall of a Casino Mobster.
You can get that on Amazon?
You can get it on Amazon or Wild Blue Press. They're located in Colorado.
Okay.
You know, his stepson's dead now.
Oh, is he really? Tony's stepson's dead.
It had been about 51 or 50.
Did he ever?
Would be now, or a man.
Did he ever go into the life?
No, it turned out to be a bad boy as far as drugs.
Oh, okay. Well, that's too bad.
But he died. He died of an overdose.
Wow, that's
he OD'd in June of last year.
Whatever happened to Tony's wife? Is she still alive?
Yeah, she's still alive. I met her in a CVS, you know, them drugstores?
Yeah.
And I bumped into her by accident, and I heard somebody say, Frank, and I didn't want to turn around. And then, Frank, and I turned around, and as I was walking, and there was this little skinny woman, and she says, you remember me? And I look, I said, I'm sorry, I don't know you. And she says, look at me. And then I said, oh, Nancy. And then she grabbed me and she started crying.
I'll be darned.
It was Tony's wife.
Huh.
And she told me that Tony forgive me and Tony's with her every day. And he knew, you know, he knew why I did it and he didn't hate me. And I'm thinking, Jesus Christ. You know, she was like half goofy.
I'll be darned.
So, and then they called her up to the counter to get her medication, and she didn't have the money. And she was short money because she was taking Oxycontin. So she was on pain pills, I guess. So I gave her $300 and was able to fill her prescription. She had no money. She's got no money.
Yeah, it wasn't
she's
like
in bad shape.
Like it wasn't like Tony really left her anything.
Yeah, he did. He left her. He left her money. He left her property. She lost the property because she was stupid. She didn't pay the taxes on it in Henderson. And construction people built all around it, and they keyed it. So it's useless. The property that's there, now the state owns it because she never paid the property, the taxes on it. And she bought this big old house, and it's got no flaws. It's sad. It's pathetic. She lives on, state aid?
Mm-hmm. Food stamps.
You know, Social Security.
She's
in bad shape. She's in bad shape.
Plus, sounds like she's probably
horrible.
Oxycontin, oxycodone addict also and late in life. So, well, it's...
That's too bad.
It's yeah, she was...
Sad end to a saga of you know, at one time they were riding high in Las Vegas. They were the toast of Las Vegas.
You know, he probably left her $1 million.
And she blew it all.
Liquid. And then, yeah, I don't know how, but she, don't forget, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I have any idea how she blew it. I know they got all that jewelry back when the government took $2 million worth of jewelry out of the gold rush on them. They did get that back after Melanie was dead 7 years. She got it back. But they only wound up with $160,000 out of that. They more or less were giving it away.
Wow.
So she got screwed there again.
Now, in your
poor thing. I feel bad for her.
Yeah, that really is too bad. Frank, in your book, Rise and Fall of Casino Mobster, which is about Tony Spilotro, he and his brother Michael, right, of course, from the movie Casino, it's a pretty brutal ending for them. Could you tell us a little bit about that? In terms of, I mean, I know if you look up on the Wikipedia, there's a couple different, they say, well, were they killed in Enos, Indiana, buried alive in a cornfield, or there was another thing here, it says
Bensonville. Let me clarify that all for you. They weren't killed in a cornfield. Their bodies were buried in a cornfield. I was in a witness protection program, so let's clarify this, too. I didn't kill Tony because I was in a witness protection program. The reason why they used Frank Vincent, who played my character in Casino, mm-hmm, is because I told Martin Scorsese, it's not a stranger that's going to bring you to get you killed. It's going to be your best friend. So that's why they used Frank Vincent killing Tony in the movie, all right, or killing Pesci.
Yeah.
To show what I said about your best friend being the one that's going to kill you. Now, when the FBI asked me, they said, Tony didn't show up for court, him and his brother. You think they ran away? Where do you think they ran to? I said, they didn't run, they're dead. He said, how do you know that? I said, because I know Tony wouldn't run. I said, I guarantee you won't find their body. Nobody wants them to show up because it's too much heat if the body comes up as a hit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, sure enough, 3 days later, the agent called me back. He says, you're right. They found him in a cornfield, him and his brother, buried with no clothes on. And I said, well, what? He said, well, we haven't gotten nothing back from the coroner yet. Then he came back and told me later that they were beaten to death, but he didn't know if they were beaten with bats or with their hands or with their feet. And I said, well, that's one of the reasons why their clothes were taken off of them for DNA, you know, and burnt separately. He said, well, where do you think they were killed? I said, no doubt, Bensonville. He said, why do you say Bensonville? I said, because somebody knows somebody that knows somebody that's connected to somebody that lives in that little town. And I know a lot of guys that went to Bensonville and died. I said, so I would bet your money it was either Bensonville or Cicero. It's Cicero. And I was right. It was Bensonville.
Yeah, that came out in the Family Secrets trial, I understand. Have you heard that story?
Yeah, from Nicholas Calabrese.
Right.
Well, I told him that before that came out in the trial about where they were, bodies were killed. And then Nicholas Calabrese verified it, you know.
And that was 2007.
I knew that Frankie. I knew the Frankie Calabrese's brother real well.
There were some bad dudes that...
Well, so basically what you're saying, though...
Frankie Calabrese, as far as I was concerned, was a coward. And he was able to do all these killings because he always had 3-4 guys with him. And you're not a tough guy when you need that many people to help you torture and kill somebody. So I would consider a man much more ruthless than him. That didn't need 3-4 guys to take a guy's body and dismember it, and that would be Lurch.
Yeah.
He was the most violent man I've ever met in my life.
Well, in the Wikipedia, there are the two sort of conflicting stories about Enos, Indiana, and then Bensonville, which you kind of affirm as being the case. But as you would say, and I think Gary Jenkins, my crime podcasting partner here, would say, when somebody takes a hit out on you, it's somebody close to you. So, I mean, in the Wikipedia here, it says basically they were kind of lured Tony and Michael in, saying that Michael was going to become a made man.
That's bullshit.
You think that was not true at all?
I don't believe that. I don't believe that. I don't believe half of that stuff that came out in that trial. I know Tony too damn well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And I know Tony wasn't going back there because they're going to make his brother a made man. That's so corny. It's ridiculous. When I seen that, I started laughing. I said, how did they create this story? The reason why Tony went back there with Michael is because Michael was in trouble. The outfit never liked Michael because he was an arrogant guy. He was an arrogant person. And the only reason why he was so arrogant is because the power his brother had, Tony. Tony's living in Vegas. Michael's living in Chicago. If Tony don't go back to Vegas, thinking in his mind that he's going to straighten this out between his brother and the outfit, and if he don't go back and they kill his brother, then there's going to be a war. And then he's going to say to himself, I may have been able to save my brother if I went back there. So in his subconscious mind, he was praying that that could happen.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as he hit them stairs going down in the basement, that's when he should have turned around and grabbed the guy that was in back of him and threw him down the stairs and ran. That's what he should have done. He should have known better. I'm surprised at Tony.
So, Frank, it sounds like, and I'd have to agree with you, a little bit I know about this, nothing like you do, but not about Michael being, they were taking him going down the basement to do the making ceremony. And I agree with you that, I mean, Michael Spilotro was not, he had not done that much that I ever knew of, that he earned that right to become a made man. And actually, they were going down there, going to that house to have a sit-down and try to straighten out the problems with Michael Spilotro and the other members of Chicago Outfit.
That's exactly what it was. Believe me. You know, they came to me and they wanted me, the government, to testify in that trial on their behalf. And they asked me questions, and they told me what they were told. And I said, I don't believe that. They looked at me. I said, I don't believe that. I said, I know Tony too well. And Michael was never going to become a made man. That's nonsense, I said. And they never called me to be a witness.
Yeah, I can see why. Yeah, Tony Spilotro.
I up their whole card.
Really? He had
I would have screwed up their whole story.
You would have. He had that native intelligence. His antenna would have been just twinging when they said, oh, we're going to make your brother a made guy. Come over here to this meeting at this house. His antenna would have been just all over the place.
That's like something out of a movie.
Yeah.
That's something you would write in a movie. I mean, it's so ridiculous. You know what I mean? You got 12 jurors up there. Or how many people are up there? They don't know their ass from a hole in the ground. They're used to watching movies.
Yeah.
You know, they could put anything on the jurors and they're going to believe it.
Yeah, the prosecutor probably knew that would resonate with them. So they came, and when Calabrese came up with that story, they probably went with it. Oh, well.
Well, I would think that people.
Well, they got what they wanted. They put everybody in jail, you know, and the government wins all the time.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, people want to believe this kind of stuff, though, don't they? So that's part of that mythology that just gets out there.
Everybody I tell what I think tells me.
No, oh, yeah.
You know, you're right. That makes more sense.
It does make a lot more sense to me. We're talking a little bit about the movie and the Petsy character of Tony Spilotro, which you've got the book about because you were like his underboss, his backup, the guy who had his back all those years in Las Vegas. So you know the story better than anybody, particularly about what happened out there. Now, working on this movie, what was it like working with Petsy? I think a lot of people would be curious about that. Did you have much to do with him, any interaction with him?
Yeah, Petsy was I used to talk every day, you know, and he was all right. Petsy was good. He was always looked for me for advice. And how to play Tony, how Tony would look and carry. He swore a little bit too much. I told him Tony didn't swear that much. But, you know, I guess he thought that was the way tough guys talk. And Tony never swore that often, you know. But the movie was like 90% correct. And, you know, I tried to give it as much truthfulness as I could. But they take that and they change it around and they're making it to fiction.
Yeah.
That's what the people want to see. They go to show fiction.
That's true. So what about Robert De Niro? Did you have much interaction with him?
Yeah, he's a very quiet guy. He's a dedicated actor. He's a good actor. I don't like his politics. I think he sucks in politics. He should mind his own business.
Yeah.
But he's a great actor. I can't take that away from him. But I don't like him no more because of his politics.
Do you think Pecci personally was could have been a tough guy had he, you know, put him out on the streets,
no.
put get him a job at the Ford Motor
no.
plant or in a bar or something? Could he have handled himself or not?
No. He's a little guy.
Okay.
He's little boned, little hands. He wasn't a tough guy. He knows how to portray tough guys, but he's not a tough guy.
Well, he can do that. Especially,
no, he's not a tough guy.
Interesting.
What about
you know? It's usually the ones that get away with it in movies. They get away with that act because it's something they want to be as a tough guy. So they know how to act like a tough guy. But tough guys don't act tough. Tough guys are just tough.
That's what I've always found. Would you have something to say here?
Well, I was just you know because you were you came up in the Chicago outfit. Did you have any? Any Joey Iuppa stories? You ever go hunting for doves?
Not really. Joey Iuppa, he's a product of Al Capone, you know. He was one of Al Capone's guys, so was Rica, Paul Rica, and Tony Arcardo. They were real close with Al Capone, and they more or less took over the Chicago outfit after Capone went to jail, you know. Iuppa was a bad man. Iuppa would okay hits like there were nothing. In other words, he didn't give a shit about life, people's lives. He was a mean man, a mean, mean man.
Interesting. We almost got a recording of him sitting with a sit-down with Nick Civella, and they met at Nick Civella's relative's house, a guy named George Schiavola, Anthony Schiavola. They knew the meet was going to happen. They broke into Schiavola's house while he was asleep upstairs. He was a Chicago police sergeant, some FBI agent with balls of steel, I'll tell you this much, broke into his house and planted some microphones on the second floor. And then they ended up having the meeting on the first floor because Iuppa had some heart problems and couldn't walk upstairs. That would have been a really interesting conversation. The head of the mob in Kansas City talking to the head
really
of the mob in Chicago.
That would have been funny as hell.
It was. Nick, I got a tape of Nick planning this all out, getting some kind of Lambrusco wine. He was real particular about what kind of wine he wanted, what kind of food he wanted, and he wanted everything to be just perfect. He wanted to know, you know, where the relatives were, where Schiavola's relatives were going to be, and how Iuppa could park up the street and then walk down and get in the house without anybody seeing him and going through the garage. It was a really fascinating tape, and it was all done in Sicilian.
In Sicilian, eh?
Yeah. Well, Nick was he and his nephew Schiavola, who lived in Chicago, both spoke Sicilian. Or spoke Sicilian, and they both spoke Sicilian. They had to have an interpreter.
Well, there's no doubt in anybody's mind that Kansas City and Chicago were hooked at the hip. You know what I mean? They were strong.
Oh, yeah.
And they were part of it. They were 100% involved with the skim with Chicago.
Yeah, Nick know. Even, he had developed
Chicago is the leading.
Yeah, Nick had even developed a whole separate stream of skim from the Tropicana outside of Chicago. They didn't have anything to do with it, and he had this Joe Gosto and Carl Thomas there skimming money, and he was sending about 25% of it every month up to Chicago, and he didn't really have to do that, but he did. Did you ever know Gosto?
No, he worked in the Tropicana. I know Joe Lombardo, when he used to come to town, he used to stay at the Tropicana. Instead of staying at the Stardust, they put him up in the Trop.
Yeah.
Joe Lombardo was a boss, too. You know that, right?
Right, right. Did you ever think about being a made guy? Did Tony ever broach that subject with you? Or was it just like something that...
Let me tell you real quick. One time I was going to switch. I was going to go to work with Dominic Cortino. He was with Jack Cerrone. And I told Tony while I was in Chicago. And Tony says, you can't do that. I said, what do you mean? I said, they want me. He said, no, you're with me. You're with me and Turk. He says, you can't jump crews. And I said, okay. So I didn't want to become a boss or a made. There's no such thing as made guys in Chicago. They use that term in New York. we didn't call each other made guys because it would just something we never used. You know, we used to call a guy a mustache, you know, or he was one of the guys, you know, he's the guy, you know, something like that. Because we knew who was who. We didn't refer to him as he. He's a made man. That's what the government put out there with New York. So when I got to Vegas, Tony said, well, now, he says, you can't duck it no more. He says, you're going to be the underboss. So that's when I became a made guy. Well, I became a member. You know, I was always connected, but then I became a boss.
Okay, so you would have been a mustache, or he's a guy. He's one of our guys, and that, yeah, was
exactly.
Enough said. Okay, I got you. Frank, it's been great having you here. Tell us the name of your book one more time, and we will let you go.
The Rise and Fall of a Casino Mapster. You could purchase it on Amazon or Wild Blue Press.
All right, great, Frank. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and we will send everybody we can out to take the...
It's the Frank Culotta Casino Mob Tour, and you can call area code 702-622-0850. Leave a voicemail message, and Frank will get back with you.
Okay, thanks. Good night, Frank.
Thank you. Good night.
Well, that was quite an interview there, Aaron. That guy, he talked about out of the mouths of the men who did it. He told us about a murder, all how he did it, and how he had to straighten Martin Scorsese out on his depiction of the Lesnar murder out there in Las Vegas. God.
Yeah, I thought that was great. He went into the, you know, if you read on Wikipedia about the Sherwin Lister murder, he definitely kind of went into the detail of how it went, and I thought it was an interesting tie into the fact that he loads his own shells too.
Exactly.
That must be like a mob thing.
No, it's a Chicago thing.
That's a Chicago thing.
Yeah, I found out about that. It's a Chicago thing. The word went around among all the Chicago guys that you use a .22, and rather than having a silencer, which were on their surface pretty suspicious and they're hard to find, you got to pay a $500 tax and register them, all that. So rather than have a silencer, they were taking their bullets and taking about half the powder out. So they said that it wouldn't be near as loud.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really work that well when they do that. I hope that they probably quit it after that.
Well, if they listen to, after they listen to this interview with Frank Culotta.
They'll definitely not do that.
I would think they would have figured that out after they couldn't kill Ken Ito.
I think they probably did figure that out after they couldn't kill Ken Ito, Tokyo Joe. You know what? We forgot to ask him what he remembers of Red Womette.
Forgot about Red Womette.
But, you know, I think he probably wouldn't have known him because he really comes from a different kind of part of the mob. He comes from the Spilatro mob, the more up around Cicero, and Red was he worked with Joey Lombardo and Frank the German Suisse, so he probably knew him by reputation. He went out to Las Vegas and never really looked back. Although he did try to come back once. I thought that was interesting. You know, I remember Bill Owsley one time said, you know, in the mob world, if they feel like they own somebody, if you work with them, they feel like they own you. Well, Tony Spilatro warned him, said, you know, you can't go jump crews and go work for somebody else. You know, you're with me, you know, and they'll say that on the... on some of the wiretaps, you know, that guy's with us.
Yeah, you got to dance with who brought you.
Right. Pretty interesting. Another interesting thing I found was that about the theory on the Michael and Tony Spilatro murders, that makes so much sense that they were going to have a sit-down and straighten something out about his brother Michael and not that they were going to have a making ceremony. That and another thing that rang really true was about how they didn't really talk about made guys. And if you think they don't call themselves the mafia up there, the mob, they call themselves the outfit. And they don't really have made guys, but you do become a made guy. And you just say, well, you know, he's a friend. Everybody know, like he said, everybody knows that guy is really in tight with the mob hierarchy. Now they do have, you know, like, crew leaders, and a lot of people, you know, we went through that with Alan, Gunner Allen Lindstrom, Lindblom, that one time about, you know, he said that he never really heard people talking about a capo or a Soto capo or a Don or anything like that. You know, you just call him Skipper or the boss. kind of like in real life, in regular life. A lot of that is made up in, for the movies. And then the government does some of that, too, in order to make it more sexy and more romantic whenever, more jury appeal.
Well, and so there's, you know, Frank Culotta at one of their four casinos, and somebody who's actually running the Chicago Skim in the count room recognizes him and says hi.
Yeah.
And they kind of, they were sort of like, don't tell anybody I know you. I won't tell anybody you know me.
That's how it works, man. That is how it works. That was a good, that was a nice little insight, too.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't supposed to know about the Skim. I remember the first time I talked to him about maybe being interviewed for my movie. Well, my movie, Gangland Wire, is primarily about the Skim. And he said, you know, he said, Tony told us, said, you don't worry about that. You take care of these other things that I tell you to take care of. And he, you know, he was not made part of that. He did the other stuff. So it was quite a story, quite an interesting interview. I'm anxious to get back and get this edited and get it up there. I'll put this up in a couple of weeks. He's got his book coming out, and people want to go buy that book, support Frank Culotta, go out and do like our good friend Barry Parks did and take the casino mob tour, the Frank Culotta's Casino Mob Tour. Is that how he called it?
It was the Frank Culotta's Casino Mob Tour, where he takes you around, I guess, to the locations from the movie Casino, and I probably talks about what he was involved when he was doing the movie. But folks can call area code 702-622-0850 and leave a voicemail message, and Frank Culotta will get back with you if you'd like to take that tour.
I think he also takes them probably by the Upper Crust, which is a pizza restaurant that the Hole in the Wall gang all hung out at all the time, And I know he goes by Lefty Rosenthal's old house, which was featured in the movie. And I know the people that own that, they like it whenever people, mob fans, come by and stop and get out in front and take pictures of it. It's right on a golf course. Probably by Tony Spilotro's old house, which is kind of in, it's close by. It's in the same neighborhood around, I think it's around the same golf course. I'm not sure. I'd have to go out there and take a look. They probably go by Bertha's, where they all got caught. You know, in the Hole in the Wall gang, the FBI had an informant in there and set them up whenever they broke into that place. They popped them all, and out of that, that's when Tony Spilotro got so paranoid, and he thought somebody was going to be ratting him out and wanting to put him in jail, and he got suspicious of Frank for no reason. We didn't go into that in great detail, but I've read enough about that he got suspicious of Frank for absolutely no reason. Frank was not going to testify, and Frank got the word that Tony was going to have him killed. And so, like I said, it came down to either Frank or Tony. And as Frank said, he'd had, 37 friends killed by the outfit?
And he didn't want to be the 38th.
He did not want to be the 38th. So talk about out of the mouth of the men that did it.
Well, and you want to read the book from Frank Culotta, Rise and Fall of a Casino Mobster, and then get the book he had before that, Hole in the Wall Gang, and his first book, Culotta.
Right. They're all co-written with our good friend Denny Griffin, who has a bunch of other books himself. So just Google the name Denny Griffin or Dennis Griffin and true crime books, and you'll find a bunch of other true crime books that he's co-authored.
Maybe we could sometime talk to Denny Griffin.
Yeah, we could. I just haven't got around to getting a hold of him. Actually, we've got another one of his books that he co-authored. Would be maybe get him and Andrew Donato, who was a mob associate in New York City. Andrew tells a hell of a story. It's one of the funniest mob stories I've ever heard. I talked to him already through Facebook, and he said he'd be happy to come on one of these nights. So we'll get Mr. Donato on here.
You know, I wanted to ask Frank this. It was really just as sort of a, you know, a curious question. I don't know if he drinks or not now, or if he has a particular place, you know, that was like a Chicago bar that was like, oh yeah, if we were in town, we'd always go to this club.
Yeah, I don't know.
Right.
In Chicago.
Well, in Chicago. He probably had a place in Vegas as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, they had that pizza place, yeah. The Upper Crust.
I know here in Kansas City, a lot of that, it all took place at their private kind of clubs, their social clubs.
Yeah, well, Kansas City, like Chicago have these little Italian-based social clubs in the city, like in New York City, like John Gotti's was at the Bergen Fish and Hunt Club, and here we had the Northview Social Club or the Columbus Park Social Club. They changed the name to it, and I'm not sure what they had in Chicago, but I'm sure they had some of those small social clubs in Chicago that they would hang out
at. They would hang out, but they were basically private clubs.
Right. If you have a friend or relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. Or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I've got to say, folks need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for rent or for sale on Amazon. And then you want to get the book that Gary just finished, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
Now, you can get the soft cover copy, but what you really want to do is get the Kindle version. So that what you can do is click on the hyperlinks. It'll take you over to some audio files that you can read the transcription while you listen to the men who committed the crimes talk about what they did.
Now, hear them talk about trying to bribe Las Vegas politicians, and hear them talking about giving exact instructions on how to skim from a casino. Hear them talking about other political machinations out in Nevada, who's winning and who's not, and Lefty Rosenthal's blackmail attempt of the governor-elect, Bob List. There's all kinds of fun stuff in that book.
And then what you want to do is download the Kansas City Mob Tour app for $1.99. You can get on your iPhone and take a personalized turn-by-turn tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. Now, I had one other thing to say. I told the bartender at Buzzard Beach, Brett, that I'd give him a shout-out because we were interviewing Frank Culotta, and he thought that was pretty neat.
All right, Brett.
Thank you, Brett, for that Genesee beer, a great beer from New York. Buzzard Beach, one of the best local late-night last-call bars in Kansas City, located in the historic Westport Entertainment District.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.
Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Find them on Facebook at Odd-O-Matic Music.
Bang! I got shot in the head.
Who do you believe ordered the hit on you, Mr. Ito?
Vincent Solano.
Second time I got shot, I thought, wow, it's not taking an effect.
Is Mr. Solano your boss in the outfit?
Yes, he is.